Hey family, King Caruso here, your Black History buff. Real quick, before the show starts, I just wanted to let you know that rather than running an ad for some random product, I've decided to bet on myself and use this spot to ask you to join me on Patreon. By joining, you'll help keep the podcast ad light, support the work that I do, and help me build a community away from the algorithms. And guess what? You can join for free. So if that sounds good, head over to Patreon and search for Black History Buff, or just check the link in the description. All right, I'm done. Now, let's jump into today's episode. Hey family, this is King Caruso, the Black History Buff. Come, let's talk. Before we begin today's episode, I need to let you know that this story contains graphic descriptions of systematic torture, physical violence, and murder, including the deaths of children. This episode also addresses themes of mental health, trauma, and the devastating effects of institutional violence. If you or someone you know has been affected by violence or trauma, please consider whether this content is appropriate for you right now. For those who choose to continue, this is an important but difficult story about the origins of America's prison system and its lasting impact on communities. This episode is based on the incredible research and scholarship found in the book Freeman's Challenge, The Murder That Shook America's Original Prison for Profit by Robin Bernstein. I cannot recommend this book highly enough. It's a masterpiece of historical research that brings a horrific story to light with the depth and rigor it deserves. If today's episode moves you in any way, please get a copy of Freeman's Challenge. Dr. Bernstein's work is essential reading for understanding how we got to the current crisis of mass incarceration. And her research uncovered details that have been buried for nearly 200 years. So with that said, let's get on with the show. Every day, I bring you stories on YouTube, my podcast, and social media that matter to our communities. Today, I want to tell you about a story that might change how you think about the American prison system. It's about a young Black man named William Freeman, who in the 1840s challenged what would become the blueprint for mass incarceration in America. Before we dive into Freeman's story, we need to understand something that most people don't realize. Prisons, as we know them, didn't exist until the 1800s. For most of human history, if you committed a crime, you faced immediate punishment, usually death. In colonial America and England, nearly everything was a capital offense. Adultery, breaking the Sabbath, stealing a horse, death. For lesser, more social crimes, the stocks and pillory were used for public humiliation. You'd be locked in these wooden contraptions in the town square while people threw rotten food, excrement, and even stones at you. Flogging was common, branding criminals on the face or hands, cutting off ears, banishment to remote colonies. But the idea of locking someone up for years as the punishment itself, that was new. Jails existed, but only as holding cells while you waited for your trial or execution. Nobody thought confinement was punishment. Why would it be? You just sat there until they decided what to actually do to you. It just didn't make sense. The modern prison was born in the early 1800s from two competing philosophies. In Pennsylvania, Quakers created what they called the separate system. Solitary confinement, 24 hours a day. Prisoners worked alone in their cells, saw no one except guards and occasional visitors. The idea was that solitude would lead to penitence, and penitence would lead to reform. But there was another model developing in New York that would change everything. In 1815, Auburn became a village in central New York. 1 year earlier, in 1816, they broke ground on what would become the most influential institution in American criminal justice history, Auburn State Prison. Auburn wasn't chosen by accident. The location offered something crucial for what its creators had in mind: water power from the Owasco River. This wasn't going to be just another place to hold criminals. This was going to be America's first prison built around profit. The Auburn system, as it came to be known, differed from Pennsylvania in one crucial way. Prisoners worked together during the day in complete silence, then returned to solitary cells at night. But here's what made Auburn revolutionary and dangerous. Those prisoners weren't just working to stay busy, they were manufacturing products for private companies. Auburn State Prison became America's first prison-for-profit operation. Private companies could lease prisoners for 30 cents per day. The prison pocketed every penny. Prisoners received nothing. By the 1820s, nearly every able-bodied male prisoner at Auburn was contracted to private companies. They manufactured furniture, harnesses, carpets, combs, shoes, boots, button tools, even steam engines. These products were sold throughout New York State and beyond. The Auburn system wasn't about justice or rehabilitation. It was about turning human beings into a revenue stream. This brings us to William Freeman. Born in 1825, Freeman was, what we must be very clear about, a free person born from free parents. His father had been manumitted. That's the legal term for being formally freed from slavery through official documentation. His mother was freeborn, descended from both Black and Stockbridge Narragansett peoples. Freeman grew up knowing what freedom looked like, knowing what it meant to be a human being with rights. This context is crucial because when Freeman was convicted of horse theft in 1840 at age 15 and sentenced to Auburn State Prison, he wasn't just any young man entering the system, he was a free citizen being forced into conditions that closely resembled slavery. When Freeman walked through Auburn's gates in 1840, he entered a world designed to systematically destroy his humanity. The warden called prisoners slaves of the state. That wasn't a metaphor. That was policy implemented through calculated torture. Silence was the biggest weapon in Auburn's arsenal, and officials knew exactly what they were doing. Deputy Warden John D. Cray and Principal Keeper Elam Lines demanded prisoners be completely silent to take away the prisoner's sense of self and prevent any human solidarity from forming. Modern medical research confirms what Auburn officials discovered through brutal experimentation. Enforced silence, combined with isolation, constitutes psychological torture. The United Nations defines solitary confinement of more than 15 days as torture. Freeman endured 5 years of this. 5 years for theft. They sentenced a 15-year-old to 5 years of torture. Earlier in the 1820s, Auburn had tried complete solitary confinement. The results were catastrophic. Out of only 83 prisoners, 5 successfully committed suicide. Others beat their heads against walls until they destroyed their own eyes. One commenter wrote, "This system doesn't reform, it kills." So, Auburn modified their approach but kept the psychological warfare. Prisoners worked together in complete silence during the day, then returned to solitary cells at night. They marched in lockstep, right hand on the shoulder of the man in front, facing the guard. They wore striped uniforms that Austin Reed called robes of disgrace. They could not speak, They could not look at each other. They could not even look at the tourists who paid to watch them suffer. The main tool of discipline was violence. Elam Lyons created his own version of the cat-o'-nine-tails whip and used flogging for even minor infractions. In 1839, a prisoner died from neglect and overflogging. But when public outcry grew about the brutality of whipping, Auburn officials didn't become more humane, they became more creative. In 1842, prison physician Joseph Pitney invented what he called the shower bath, a torture device that would make the Spanish Inquisition proud. The shower bath was a stocks-like contraption that restrained a prisoner at the neck, wrists, and ankles. Water poured or gushed from above for about 15 to 45 minutes over the prisoner. Auburn used up to 11 barrels of water, over 340 gallons, and would sometimes add ice and snow to drop the temperature to 35 degrees. Austin Reed, who endured this torture along with Freeman, described it as drowning. My hands, feet, and head were made fast, and then the cruel work commenced, he said, and did not stop till I had received 11 barrels of water. The mere thought of it made him shiver and ache all over. The machine caused what prison doctor Blanchard Fosgate called strangulation of the most painful degree. It was water torture. It induced aberration of mind, convulsions, congestion of the brain, liver, and bowels. It caused blindness, deafness, and madness. One inspector noted that the minds of convicts had been impaired and in some cases ruined by the bath. Samuel Moore, a black prisoner, died from the shower bath torture. As a prison doctor watched, Moore's death struggles were so fierce that watching his hands free from their firm fastenings, he slipped from his seat and was actually hung by his neck while in the stocks. Freeman was subjected to this same water torture. After one incident of talking back to a supervisor, he was forced to the shower bath's corridor, which was continually wet from the device's frequent use. He was stripped, locked into the machine, and tortured. Here's what makes Auburn's brutality even more sickening. It was a tourist attraction. Auburn charged 25 cents for adults, 12 and a half cents for children, to watch human beings being systematically destroyed. Families paid money to bring their children to observe torture disguised as correction. Tourists were escorted through the prison's factory floors to watch prisoners work in complete silence or through hidden tunnels where they could observe prisoners without being seen. These tours added to the prison's profits while allowing visitors to observe human beings reduced to silent, profitable labor. Those same prisoners who were being watched and degraded for entertainment were forbidden from looking back at their tormentors. They could not speak, could not react, could not acknowledge the inhumanity of the people watching them like animals in a zoo. For all its brutality, Auburn was considered a model institution. It was the most visited prison in America. International observers came to study its methods, Auburn's innovations, the lockstep, the striped uniforms, the enforced silence, the profit-driven labor spread to prisons across the country because they were profitable, not because they were humane. When they put Freeman to work in Auburn's factories, something happened that threatened the entire system. Freeman did what no prisoner was supposed to do. He demanded wages. His argument was simple but devastating. He insisted he was not a slave but a citizen with rights. He was a worker who deserved compensation for his labor. When officials called this thinking delusional, Freeman pushed back harder. "I have been in prison 5 years unjustly," Freeman said when he was finally released in September 1845, and ain't going to settle so. This wasn't just one angry prisoner complaining. This was a fundamental challenge to Auburn's defining idea. If Freeman was right, if prisoners were workers deserving wages rather than slaves of the state, then the entire profit model collapsed. To understand why Freeman's challenge was so dangerous, we need to look at what was happening in America at the same time. This was the 1840s. Frederick Douglass was writing his autobiography. The abolition movement was gaining steam. Debates about slavery were tearing the country apart. But while everyone was focused on slavery in the South, Freeman was exposing slavery in the North. Slavery hiding inside the justice system itself. The North Star, Frederick Douglass's own newspaper, was one of the few publications to take Freeman's wage demand seriously. They wrote, "Never was there a more righteous demand than this." But that support came after Freeman had already been driven to violence.
"Excuse me, so sorry to disturb you, but you look like you love Black history. And if I'm right, you need to check out the Black History Buff Village over on Patreon. There's no ads or annoying interruptions like this. Just post after post of beautiful Black history. When you get a minute, please check it out. You won't regret it. Link's in the description. All right, I'm off now. Bye."
When Freeman walked out of Auburn in September 1845, he was no longer the playful, talkative boy who had entered 5 years earlier. His brother-in-law, John DuPuy, was shocked by what prison had done to him. The boy who could once read very well now struggled with basic comprehension. His gait was off rhythm, his voice was dull and monotone, his head hung low or listed to one side, his eyes moved independently of his head in ways that people found peculiar and disturbing. Freeman had been systematically tortured for 5 years. His hearing had been destroyed by blows to his head, his mind shattered by the shower bath torture and the psychological warfare of enforced isolation and silence. The water torture, the beatings, the deliberate destruction of his humanity, all of it had broken something fundamental inside him. What Freeman did first proves that even in his damaged state, he understood justice better than his torturers did. When Freeman was released from Auburn, prison officials handed him $4.50. Not as payment for 5 years of labor, but travel money to fund his journey home and immediate needs. Freeman looked at those four coins, the same amount he might have earned in a single day of free labor, after 5 years of generating wealth for private companies and the prison itself. This broken man, who could no longer understand the words "half doll" printed on those very coins, still grasped something fundamental. He had been robbed. 2 months after his release, Freeman tried to get justice through the legal system. He told DuPuy he wanted pay for his time in prison and asked for help finding lawyers. This was extraordinary for any Black man in 1845. Voluntarily navigating a legal system designed to protect white interests. Freeman brought 3 formal complaints to Magistrate James Bostwick. First, he wanted compensation for 5 years of unpaid labor. Second, he wanted arrests for the people who had wrongfully convicted him. Jack Furman, who had accused him, David Simpson, the constable who had arrested him, and Martha Godfrey, who owned the horse he had allegedly stole. Freeman's demand was clear and rational. "I had been there 5 years for nothing." He loaded double meaning into that word, nothing. Both no crime committed and no wages paid. He said the state owed him for 5 years' work and they had to pay him, or someone had got to pay him. The magistrate dismissed him, No lawyer would take the case. The legal system that had tortured him for 5 years refused to provide any remedy for the theft of his labor and the destruction of his mind. 6 months after the legal system dismissed his claims, Freeman's shattered psyche finally snapped entirely.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
On the evening of March 12, 1846, he armed himself with knives and a bayonet and walked 2.5 miles to the Van Nest family farm in Fleming. What happened that night was unspeakably brutal. Freeman entered the Van Nest home and systematically murdered 4 people. John Van Nest, his pregnant wife Sarah, their young son George, and a visiting relative Phoebe Wyckoff. John Van Nest was stabbed multiple times and died trying to protect his family. Sarah Van Nest, 6 months pregnant, was stabbed repeatedly. Little George Van Nest, just a child, was stabbed to death. And Phoebe Wyckoff survived the initial attack, but died of her injuries 2 days later. The scene was so horrific that it terrorized the entire region. Freeman had not just killed, he had slaughtered an entire family, including a child and an unborn baby. The brutality was beyond what most people could comprehend. Freeman made no attempt to flee. He was found nearby, covered in blood, with the murder weapons. When captured and interrogated by local officials, Freeman's explanation was as chilling as the crime himself. He told interrogator James Bostwick and others that he was 5 years in state prison wrongfully and made up his mind that somebody must pay for it. When pressed about his reasoning, Freeman explained his twisted logic. He believed if he killed around the country, they would pay. Freeman didn't target the Van Nests for personal reasons. He had never met them before that night. When investigators suggested he might have personal grievances against the family, Freeman corrected them. "Nobody ever told me that Mr. Van Nest got me to state prison," he said. "This wasn't revenge against specific people. This was the explosion of a mind that had been deliberately broken by years of torture, seeking payment through the only currency his damaged psyche could conceive, terror and death." When I think about what Auburn's systematic torture had done to Freeman's mind, how they had taken a freeborn citizen and methodically destroyed his humanity until he became capable of such horror, one word captures what the prison had created. Shattered. Drop that word in the comments if you caught it. That's this week's keyword. Freeman's story is a cascade of preventable tragedies. The first tragedy was his wrongful imprisonment at age 15. The second tragedy was the systematic torture he endured for 5 years. The third tragedy was the complete denial of justice when he sought legal remedies. And the fourth tragedy, the one that could have been prevented if any of the earlier injustices had been addressed, was the brutal murder of an innocent family. If Freeman had received fair wages for his labor, if the torture had been stopped, if a lawyer had taken his case, if the magistrate had issued warrants for his wrongful conviction, the Van Nest family would still be alive. Instead, each failure created the conditions for the next tragedy. Here's what's crucial about this. White Auburn couldn't handle what Freeman had exposed about their precious prison system. So they did what America always does when black people reveal the truth about white institutions. They buried the issue under racist narratives. Rather than acknowledging Freeman's legitimate critique of prison labor or theft, they made it about his supposed inherent criminality. Prosecutors called witnesses who testified that as a child, Freeman had allegedly thrown stones at white boys and that he had an ugly temper. They painted his demand for wages as a delusion rather than a legitimate claim for stolen labor. One minister wrote the following: "The wretch from his cradle to the cell, because he was the son of a Negro." The narrative became that Freeman was criminal by nature, not that he was a torture victim driven to madness by years of systematic abuse. The very people who had designed and implemented the torture that destroyed Freeman's mind now pointed to his damaged mental state as proof of his inherent inadequacy. It's the ultimate in racist gaslighting. Torture someone until they break, then blame them for being broken. Freeman died in prison before his appeal could ever be heard. But his challenge didn't die with him. In fact, it became prophetic. 20 years after Freeman challenged Auburn, the 13th Amendment was ratified in 1865. It prohibited slavery and involuntary servitude, except as a punishment for crime, whereof the party shall have been duly convicted. That exception, the exact loophole Freeman was fighting against in 1840, became the foundation for convict leasing in post-Civil War South chain gangs and what we now call the prison industrial complex. Southern lawmakers immediately exploited this loophole. They passed black codes that criminalized everything from unemployment to showing improper respect. Black people found themselves imprisoned for minor infractions, then leased to plantations and industrial sites to work without pay. Many ended up on the very plantations where they or their families had been enslaved. The Auburn system that Freeman challenged became the model for prisons across America. By 1850, nearly every state had adopted some version of Auburn's silent system and prison labor models. Hey family, I hope you're enjoying the episode so far. Yes, this is an ad, but it's an ad for me. I forgot to mention at the start of the episode that along with Patreon, I also have a newsletter that you can join for free. Isn't it refreshing to get an ad for free stuff for once? The newsletter is something I set up to keep in touch with like-minded people who don't love being glued to apps, but still want to keep up to date with what's going on through the good old written word, you know, like our ancestors did back in the 90s. You can find a link to join in the description. Okay, I'm out. Thanks for sticking around. I appreciate you, and please enjoy the rest of the show. Freeman's challenge to Auburn State Prison in the 1840s is the exact same challenge activists are making today. Right now, prisoners in America produce over $2 billion worth of goods annually, while earning between 13 cents and $1.15 per hour. Companies like McDonald's, Walmart, Victoria's Secrets, and IBM have all profited from prison labor. In some states, prisoners who refuse to work face punishment, including solitary confinement. The 13th Amendment exception is still there, still being exploited, still allowing what prisoners correctly call modern slavery. In 2018, prisoners across the country went on strike, demanding fair wages and the end of forced labor. Strike leaders were punished with solitary confinement, the same response Freeman got 180 years ago. But there's hope. Since 2018, several states have removed the slavery exception from their state constitutions. Vermont, Alabama, Tennessee, Oregon, and Nevada have all passed amendments explicitly outlawing forced prison labor. The one with that accept as punishment for crime loophole that Freeman was fighting against, that still stands. What Freeman understood in 1840 is what activists understand today. Prison labor creates perverse incentives. When prisons profit from prison labor, they have economic reasons to keep people locked up and lock more people up. Auburn charged tourists to watch prisoners work. Today, private prison companies lobby for harder sentencing laws. Auburn made money leasing prisoners to private companies. Today, corporations get tax incentives for using prison labor instead of outsourcing to other countries or the general population. The prison model that Freeman exposed hasn't changed. It's just evolved and expanded. Why this story matters is because he saw through all the rhetoric about rehabilitation and paying your debt to society to the economic reality underneath. Auburn State Prison wasn't about making anybody a better person. It was about making money off his body and his labor. And here we are in closing. Freeman's challenge to Auburn State Prison in the 1840s was a challenge to the entire foundation of American punishment. He refused to accept that justice could be a cover for organized theft. Freeman's story also teaches us something crucial about the difference between justice and vengeance. Our current prison system is built on vengeance. The idea that inflicting suffering on people who have caused harm will somehow balance the scales. But as Freeman's case shows us, a system based on vengeance and profit creates more victims, not fewer. And for anyone listening who thinks I'm being soft on crime or that I've never been touched by violence, I need to tell you something personal. A very gruesome murder took place in my family. The perpetrator was never caught. I know what it means to lose someone you love to senseless violence, to have your whole family nearly shattered by that loss. But I've moved beyond the point of wanting vengeance from that person. My only wish now for whoever committed that murder is that they have repented of their crimes and they spend the rest of their life trying to live a good life, a productive life, causing no more harm to anyone. I want that person to have truly turned their life around so that they are trying to put as much good into the world as the hurt they caused by taking away someone I loved from me. For me, that's what real justice looks like. Not more suffering, but genuine repentance and transformation that prevents future harm. Freeman needed mental health intervention, not torture. He needed education and opportunity, not systematic dehumanization. The Auburn system's focus on punishment and profit meant that instead of addressing the factors that led to his initial conviction, they created a monster capable of unspeakable violence. Real justice would have meant addressing Freeman's needs early, providing genuine rehabilitation, and ensuring he receives fair compensation for his labor. Instead, a system designed for vengeance and profit created a cascade of tragedies that destroyed multiple families, both Freeman's family and the Van Nest family. The system Freeman fought killed him and innocent people, but his challenge lives on. Every prisoner who was ever organized for decent wages, every activist who has ever exposed prison profiteering, every community that has ever demanded real alternatives to incarceration, they're all fighting Freeman's fight for a system that creates healing instead of more harm. History is made every day, family. And sometimes, the most important history is made by people who refuse to accept that exploitation disguised as justice is just the way things have to be. The Auburn system evolved into our modern prison industrial complex. That accept as punishment for crime loophole he was fighting against is still in the Constitution. Understanding some of that history is the first step towards finally finishing what William Freeman started, creating a system based on rehabilitation and restoration, not vengeance and profit. You've been listening to King Karooz the Black History Buff. Keep making history, and please stay blessed. Hey guys, it's me, King Karooz. And if you're listening to this on Patreon, you may be wondering why I've released this episode again. If you're hearing this and you're not subscribed to my Patreon, and you really should be, then it's because I've decided that what I share at the end of this little message is too important to keep behind a paywall. Anyway, the last version I released wasn't mixed properly, but I wanted to get something out to you. To you, my Patreon family, as quickly as possible, so I gave you the 80% mixed version. Because I'm dedicated to bringing you all the very best work I can, I went back, looked at my recording setup, switched out my microphone for a different one, and introduced a new door into my setup, which means going forward, I'm gonna have much cleaner audio and hopefully bring you even better sound quality. I'll share images of what I swapped in along with the post on Patreon. I've now gone through this episode and mixed it all down, so it should be a much easier, smoother listen. There are still some artifacts in there that I can't completely eliminate, but those should be minimized going forward. And as a special treat and as a thank you to those who've been patient while I remastered this, I've also added some questions that I posed to the author of Freeman's Challenge. I've included them at the end of this audio, so please stick around and listen to that. It's a short recording, but it's really powerful to hear from the author directly. Once again, thank you all. I appreciate your support so much. Thank you to Kara and to Feds for their feedback on the audio. And thank you to everyone who's helping me make this project better. And with that said, here is Dr. Robin Bernstein.
Hello, I'm Robin Bernstein, and I'm the author of Freeman's Challenge, The Murder That Shook America's Original Prison for Profit. Question one. What initially drew you to William Freeman's story, and why did you feel it was important to write this book? I stumbled upon William Freeman's story by accident. It was in a footnote, and I got really interested when I learned that he had been incarcerated in the Auburn State Prison in 1840, where he had been leased as a convict. He had been forced to labor 12 hours a day. And when I found out that William Freeman had been subjected to convict leasing in New York State in 1840, I thought, what? I always associated convict leasing with the South after the Civil War. I associated it with the 13th Amendment, to the U.S. Constitution, which famously, notoriously outlawed involuntary servitude except as a punishment for crime. So I thought, how is there convict leasing in New York State in the North decades before the Civil War? And that was the first moment when I thought there's something really interesting and important here. So I thought also, if I don't know that history, if I think the origins of convict leasing and profit-driven incarceration are in the South, if I don't know its real origins, maybe some other people don't know it either. And that's why I felt it was important to write this book. Question two. During your research, what were some of the most surprising or challenging aspects of Freeman's story that you uncovered? Well, Freeman's story is a violent story. There's a murder in this book, and you know that from the title. I'm not giving away anything. And it's difficult to write about violence. It's really hard because you don't want to reinscribe the violence. You don't want to affirm it in any way. You certainly don't want to sensationalize it. And at the same time, I didn't want to trivialize it. I didn't want to suggest that it was no big deal, but I also didn't want to overemphasize it. So it was a very difficult line to walk. And the way I walked that line was by trying to always tell the truth. I thought my primary goal here is to tell the truth about William Freeman, about his experience in the Auburn State Prison, the violence that he was subjected to in the Auburn State Prison, and also the violence that he ultimately committed. I felt that it was very important as a matter of respect for William Freeman to tell the story of the violence in a way that was completely truthful. Question 3. The murder is pretty gruesome. Did you worry that the nature of the crime would overshadow the sentiment behind writing the book? Absolutely, I worried about that. I worried about that every single day. I wanted to make sure that William Freeman emerged in the book as a full human being, a flawed human being, but also a person who really had something important to say. What William Freeman was saying, both with words and with actions, was that profit-driven incarceration is wrong, that the Auburn State Prison, when it subjected him to convict leasing, had stolen his labor, that it had effectively enslaved him, and that that was wrong. Number 4, Freeman's story highlights the intersection of racism and the criminal justice system in 19th century America. How do you see his experience resonating with contemporary issues of mass incarceration and the prison industrial complex? There are so many resonances between the story that I'm telling about the 19th century and today. The most common response I've gotten to the book is, this is so contemporary. You could be describing something that happens today. I was very honored that somebody I know who was formerly incarcerated told me that the book captured some of his own personal experience. And on the one hand, I'm very sorry to hear that because the experiences in the book are very difficult. On the other hand, I was moved that by telling the truth about William Freeman, I was able to also tell the truth about one person, at least in the contemporary moment, and his personal experience of incarceration. So the most important connections between the Auburn system, which was invented in New York State starting in 1816, and today, the most important thing to know about those connections is that they are literal and direct. The Auburn State Prison invented the idea that a prison can and should be an economic force. And that idea then spread, and the practices of convict leasing that were developed in Auburn then spread. They spread to New York, they spread across New England, they spread to across the United States and eventually all over the world. So we can think of some of the most famous prisons in America, Parchman, The Walls, San Quentin, Angola. All of these were directly influenced by the Auburn State Prison and specifically by its practices of viewing prisoners as an economic resource. That was a radically new idea in 1816. And that idea has penetrated the entire world. The way I'd like to explain it sometimes is like this. Imagine that you want to build a prison in a small town, and you need to convince people in this town that this is a great idea. They really want to support this prison. What are the arguments that you would use? Would you say that prisons deliver justice and your town really values justice, and therefore you should welcome the prison because it's going to make your town a more just place? Would you argue that prisons help make people better, that prisons reform people, and that's what your town is all about? Your town is all about supporting people, helping people become better, helping people fulfill their own potential, and therefore you should be really happy to have a prison because the prison is going to help do all that. Or would you argue that the prison will bring jobs and you should support the prison because it will be good for the local economy? Well, I think it's pretty obvious that the first two arguments would have no success at all. It's the third argument that could potentially convince people to support a prison. And that fact, that third argument seems logical when, by the way, it is not logical. By the way, it's a really bizarre idea. But the fact that it doesn't seem bizarre, the fact that it seems logical and normal, that's a direct result of the Auburn State Prison. The only reason that prisons can seem logically to be good for the economy, the only reason for that, that if that idea is embedded in you, it was embedded there 200 years ago by the people who I am talking about in my book. In your opinion, this is question number 5. In your opinion, what are the most important lessons that modern readers can draw from Freeman's story and the legacy of the Auburn State Prison? Well, I think one really important lesson that people can draw today is that prisons purchase people's consent. They purchase people's consent and make illogical arguments appear to be logical. If we believe that prisons are inevitable, if we believe that prisons are necessary, that if we believe that we can't have a world without prisons, the reason we believe that is because people who have been making money off of prisons have convinced us of that fact. One of the things that really surprised me when I was writing Freeman's Challenge, The Murder That Shook America's Original Prison for Profit, was that people were convinced that prisons were absolutely necessary and inevitable within a few years of them being invented. That people in Auburn were absolutely convinced that the Auburn State Prison was unassailable, that nothing could ever topple it. And they were convinced of that practically before it was even finished being built. So if we have this sense that prisons are unassailable, that there are no other options, that we cannot possibly have a world without prisons, the reason we believe that is because of 200 years of cultural work to convince us of that fact. It wasn't true 200 years ago, and it's not true now. Question 7. As a historian, what do you hope your book will contribute to ongoing conversations about racial justice, prison reform, and the role of history in shaping our present and future? When we overemphasize the South in the history of profit-driven prison, when we tell the story of profit-driven prison only from the perspective of the South, what we're doing is we're starting the story in the middle. And the problem with that is that if we start the story in the middle, we're leaving out the part where the North, not the South, actually invented convict leasing and profit-driven prison in this country. And when we do that, what we are doing is we are inadvertently letting the North off the hook. We're letting the North off the hook for the invention of convict leasing, and we're also letting the North off the hook for all of the racism that entangles with profit-driven prison. Racism entangles with profit-driven prison in the South and in the North and in the West and everywhere else. So what I want to do in Freeman's Challenge is put the North back on the hook. I want to expose the North's culpability in the invention of profit-driven prison and also in the entanglement of racism and incarceration that followed that invention. So that's what I really hope people will take away from Freeman's Challenge. I hope what they'll know is that the North is a really important part of this story about profit-driven incarceration and racism in the United States. Thank you so much.
Warning, the following ZipRecruiter radio spot you are about to hear is going to be filled with F-words.
When you're hiring, we at ZipRecruiter know you can feel frustrated, forlorn even, like your efforts are futile, and you can spend a fortune trying to find fabulous people, only to get flooded with candidates who are just fine. Fortunately, ZipRecruiter figured out how to fix all that. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. With ZipRecruiter, you can forget your frustrations because we find the right people for your roles fast, which is our absolute favorite F word. In fact, 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day.
Fantastic.
So, whether you need to hire 4, 40, or 400 people, get ready to meet first-rate talent. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/zip to try ZipRecruiter for free. Don't forget, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. Finally, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip.